Again, welcome everyone, and it's a seven-part series. We are in week one of seven. The topic is Jews and clothes, and I see a couple of people here who I think would have been in this series when I did it in 2013. We did Jews and clothes at Beth Emeth at the time, but there's new content. I'm adding topics, revisiting stuff, revising stuff, because I hope that none of us are the same person we were 9 years ago. So in a good way. So even if you were here 9 years ago, I still think you'll come away with something new and different, although you may recognize some of the sources on the source sheet, in particular some of the fun ones that I really enjoyed. If you're on and you have not yet registered for the class, you always can. It's torontotorah.com/Wednesday, and that will be great. I do plan to continue the practice of sending out follow-up emails after class for items that we don't get to, or revisiting certain things, or sending out the link for the audio recording. So that should be coming to you, God willing, later today. I will ask, last year or the year before, I started to send out the source sheet again on the morning of the class. In other words, I send it out in advance, usually Sunday or Monday, and then send it out again Wednesday morning. Do people find that useful or annoying?
Yeah.
Okay, people do find it useful.
I just ran it off, but you know, life is getting busier and more things going on, so it's nice to have another reminder.
Okay, so if you find it useful, then I'll do it. Okay.
I'm obsessive, so I have to apologize because I always ask you in advance. Apologies.
Yes. If anyone here is not getting the emails, it may be that you didn't register. Please make sure that you do that. Okay, but let's get started. The session for today, the Jewishness of the fashion industry or the fashion business. I've written different things in different places. So it's a little comical for me to be speaking about this because I have no fashion sense. I've never had fashion sense. I still remember, I think it was my first year in university, I wore black jeans every single day. Not because they were fashionable, but because they were easy. I wear my usual black and white or navy and white because I cannot figure out how to match striped shirts with ties. Don't offer me help. Don't send me a website. I am irredeemable in this area. So that's just the way it is. But nonetheless, I do have some things to say about, as you know, we titled it, the fashion industry and the Jewishness of the fashion industry. So I want to start out with four brief articles which involve, so to speak, Jewish clothing in different ways. And I'm going to poll you afterwards. I'm going to give you a poll on which ones you consider to be Jewish of this list of four. So let's take a look. The first one is called Shmata Chic. That's the article by Alana Newhouse. This appeared in Slate, the online magazine. At Fashion Week in New York last month, mind you, this was 2007, Brazilian designer Alexandra Hershkovich didn't so much unveil a collection as veil one. His aggressively modest looks, I find that very funny, aggressively modest. His aggressively modest looks included below-the-knee skirts, billowing silhouettes, and most conspicuously, hats. Lots of elaborate, distinctly undainty hats, which bore a striking resemblance to, of all things, those worn by fashionable Orthodox Jewish women on holy days, making Hershkovich's runway seem less like a Saturday at the shows than Sabbath in certain synagogues. Hershkovich is mining a past very much his own. The 35-year-old, whose Jewish grandparents immigrated to Brazil from Poland in the early 1900s, attended yeshiva, and enthusiastically points to his religious background as an inspiration. Quote, I was influenced by the modest Jewish attitudes of dress, of not showing the body, Hershkovich once told the Jerusalem Post, underscoring that, quote, this goes strongly against the body beautiful culture of Brazil. So the argument here is that modest clothing is distinctly Jewish. That's the argument that Hershkovich seems to be making. So that's item number one, case number one of clothing that somebody is calling Jewish. I'm not calling for comments right now on any of the four. I want us to see all four of them before we weigh in. Okay. So that's the first one. Then number two. And number two, an article on the synagogue dress code by Maureen Adler Marx. I don't remember where this first appeared. I went looking for it because I really enjoyed it and wanted to go back and revisit it. Couldn't find it. When I was growing up in New York, my favorite Rosh Hashanah ritual was this of a new Jewish suit. Despite the threat, which is funny also, a new Jewish suit. I don't know exactly what that means. Despite the threat of Indian summer heat, year after year I would be in shul, sweltering in blue wool, dripping with sweat and pride, duped by seasonal change again. In Los Angeles now, of course, we're laid back. New clothing merely means a new black cotton t-shirt. The other day at Torah study, we discussed the controversy of Jewish jeans. Is it all right to wear denims and running shoes to services? Whatever, shrugged the well-dressed rabbi, dapper in Armani. But with the growing influence of the ashram and the recent adoption of meditation-style worship, it's only a matter of time until our clothing goes with the flow. Sorry? Okay.
I think everybody has to mute themselves.
Oh, no, that's all right. I muted everybody before. I just want to make sure that no one's having a technical problem. Okay. Continuing in number two. She writes, frankly, I'll miss dress-up Judaism, and like the recent readoption of the yarmulke, predict it will one day stage a comeback. Business attire at services, especially heels, is miserably restrictive. But that's the point, a beginning of self-containment. You've got to start somewhere, you know, and tshuva, the spiritual chiropractic generally known as repentance, is hard work. Many of my best intentions fail me. If I can't easily change my habits, drives, ambitions, and motivations, at least I can alter my hemline. We change slowly from the outside in. I like that line, right? It's a lot easier to change the clothing than to change yourself. So here, what I'm seeing is the idea of Jewish clothing as synagogue clothing, and in particular, being dressed in a certain way that expresses a certain respect for the environment one is in, for what's going on in the synagogue. That's a second kind of Jewish clothes. Again, as I said before, for anyone who just joined, we're not going to comment on each one individually. We're going to see all four, take a poll, and then we can comment on them. The third one, an article that appeared in People magazine in 2003 regarding a line of clothing called Rabbi's Daughters. I've always wanted to do a line called Rabbi's Daughters, says Daniela, the youngest of Los Angeles Rabbi Jerry Cutler's three gals. In June, we came up with a simple idea, had a brainstorming session, and the next thing you know, oi, 2 months later, their line of tops with Yiddishisms, like Yenta, which they give you in parentheses, they give you translations, but I think I'm going to skip the parentheses. You can read them for yourself. Yenta, Goy Toy, Shena Punin on them were selling like hot latkes. The celeb fan base quickly followed. Madonna, Christina Aguilera, and Kelly Osbourne sport Shiksa, and Mandy Moore snagged Oy Vey. So, clothing with Yiddishisms on it. Is that Jewish clothing? That's very entertaining, the live transcript and what it does with it. Okay. And then finally, number four, an article from Time magazine in 2003, The Chosen Couture. Young consumers are turning to micro fashion lines to assert their Jewish pride. Sarah Lefton began her career as head of the hip micro clothing line Jewish Fashion Conspiracy, quote, as a joke, really. Her day job as the marketing director of a summer camp in Yosemite National Park provided the inspiration. She made up a few t-shirts bearing the slogan, Yo, Semite, for her own amusement. And she says, I kept getting stopped in the street. Within 2 days, she had taken orders for 36 shirts and a new career was born. She has also contributed to a fashion trend. Conversation-provoking t-shirts, hats, and even underwear emblazoned with expressions of secular Jewish pride. At JewishFashionConspiracy.com, you can find Lefton's pro-Semitic shirts. Julo.com showcases Julia Lowenstein's Hebraic spin on JLo. And at JewishJeans.com, there are no jeans yet, but there are 21 styles of t-shirts with slogans like nice Jewish girl. The new designers join the popular clothing company Juicy in celebrating kosher style fabulosity. Why this vogue now? Quote, younger Jews are accepting their Jewish identity and looking for ways to represent, says Julo's Lowenstein, 27. With the alarming rise in anti-Semitism on college campuses, as well as in the national consciousness, young Jews are feeling that now is an especially important time to be forthright and proud of who they are. She notes, though it's hard to implement mass change through fashion, the shirts are a positive step towards more Jewish pride among the younger generation. So our fourth example is clothing meant to promote Jewish pride. So I'm going to launch a poll, which you could all respond to, in which, there it goes. This is anonymous, by the way. Neither I nor anybody here will see who says what. But the question is, which of these are valid examples of Jewish clothing? You can choose as many as you want. The modest clothing described in source 1, the dress-up ritual clothing described in source 2, the clothing with Yiddish messages described in source 3, the clothing meant to promote Jewish pride described in source 4. You can make your selection. Again, you can select as many of them as you like. And after we get enough responses, oh, or none of the above. Sorry, forgot to note that one. Someone clicked none of the above. So once we have enough responses, I will close the poll and share the results with you. Everybody gets to see the answers. Whichever one of the polls does not, you know, whichever one of the answers gets, you know, enough can run the Knesset if they want, or they can make a coalition with none of the above. I'll give people another 20 seconds. Oh, maybe I won't need to. We already have 27 of 30 respondents already. So only 3 people are holding out. I don't know who is holding out, but I'm going to close the poll in another couple of seconds. We got 28 of 30 answering. Okay, I'm sharing the results. So as you can see on your screen, we have the winners are the first 2. Modest clothing got 18 votes out of the 28 who responded. Dress-up ritual clothing got 16 votes out of the 28 who responded. Clothing meant to promote Jewish pride from the fourth one got eight. And then none of the above got 5 votes. None of these are Jewish clothing. And then the least, only 2 people said the clothing with Yiddish messages is Jewish clothing. So I have to say I'm not entirely surprised by the answers. But I do want to ask about, your reactions here to each of them. I'm just writing down the poll results before I, move this off of the screen. So, I see that we had 18 people say the modest clothing and 16 people say the synagogue clothing, the, refined clothing for the synagogue. I kind of expected that was going to be, the winner on that front. Any comments on the get to some of the more controversial ones? Rose, I see your hand up, but is it about those? It is. Okay, go ahead.
So I think that it's how you were raised, right? So we were raised to go to first of all, Yontif, we had to have a new dress. That was like a must have. And you had to wear a dress. That was just how it was, and that was modest, right? And to this day, it's the same thing. On a Friday, about in the Seder for an address. It's what you've been raised with.
Right. That's on clothing number two, the refined clothing. Betty, yeah.
Okay, I have issues with respect, and I'm not sure it's entirely how we're raised, but jeans to shul, to me, is totally inappropriate. I've said this to when I see even kids going in, if they were having a meeting with the prime minister, would they dress up or would they go in jeans? And if going to shul to pray isn't just as important at or more, then I just don't get the, I've seen jeans with the holes all the way down the legs and a cropped shirt walk into synagogue, and I'm like, it's very disrespectful, in my opinion.
Well, let me ask you. I see your hand, Diane. Where do you want those people to be instead? In other words, if you give those people a choice between changing their clothing or simply leaving the synagogue, you know which one they're going to choose.
Yes, I've been told it by people, because I've seen it on Sunday, go to the Catholic Church at Avenue and Wilson, like that. I'd rather have my children go to pray than not go, so they can wear whatever they want. I understand that, however, I still think that there has to be some respect for where you're going, and I would thankfully, my children and grandchildren agree, because I'm not saying we at our shul, there are women in pants now. I'm just saying that the mid section being there, the holes in the leg, to me, not.
I hear what you're saying, and I'm not weighing in yet, although I do plan to ultimately. Diane, you had your hand up, but you're muted. Well, when I talk about having a hand up, just for those who have the ability to use the hand up option on your on your screen, that works better than having to hold your hand up, because then it's just the computer's doing it for you. Diane, you were saying?
Well, it's a question of what we used to call modesty, dressing appropriately for shul. And I myself have always worn, of course, a skirt or a dress. But when I had back surgery and I can't bend to put on pantyhose, I have to wear pants.
Mm.
So if I want to go to shul, I wear pants.
Right.
And it's a matter of circumstance, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But do your pants have holes all the way down their leg?
Well, I'm not 15 or 25, so I don't know.
Right. No, but there is something to be said about where the clothing choice isn't simply about what I feel like wearing, but it's imposed on you by health circumstances. Like, that's a different story. Rosalind, and then Dahlia, and then Sylvia, I think, and then Marilyn.
Oh, I wanted to make a comment about number one, and I find this very interesting, because perhaps this designer was influenced by his Orthodox grandparents. But I think that clothing is more important than just style. Clothing is a reflection of the times. And if he is designing these longer skirts and big hats, then perhaps it reflects the times. I mean, we dress differently, even to go to shul now, than we did in the 1980s before. Power suits and big shoulders, and perhaps this was reflective of 2000, I don't even remember even 2007, but perhaps it was reflective, or it was different, or it went against the grain of everything I know about Brazil. So I don't know whether it has anything to do with Judaism per se, but it's a reflection of his muse or whatever.
Right. Now, I mean, I hear you, and it's definitely something I've seen more than once. It's very interesting where you get, on the one hand, designers, and not only designers, you see it, you know, models and so on, who will say, I'm specifically going the more modest route because I'm fed up with objectification. And then on the other hand, you see people who rebel against this kind of idea because they say it's being imposed upon us instead of being a choice. Obviously, the extreme example is what's going on in Iran today. But the my focus wasn't so much, and this is a response to Toby's comment in the chat as well, my focus is not so much on the use of it on the runway as the idea that modest clothing would be something that would be called Jewish clothing. That's really where my focus was. Not so much on the you know, this particular designer or Brazil. Dahlia. Sorry, what?
She's muted. I'm not muted.
No, but Roslyn, you were gonna say something in response,
yeah,
or
yeah. No, what I wanted to say was that you know, there's been a huge change in even in Orthodox shuls in terms of, you know, hats and how women cover their hair or don't cover their hair when they come to shul when they're married. You know, the whole, I have there's a whole fashion in New Jersey. My cousin who had a hat store for years now calls herself the doilylady.com, and she sells doilies for all the affairs and weddings and for shul, and you could, the same way you have yarmulkes, people hand out doilies to the women now, apparently, in New Jersey. So that is the fashion. And she's making a bundle on this. She has them made by somebody in China, and she has fashion statement doilies in every color, like the old-fashioned yarmulkes that came in satin.
Yeah.
If you remember, and this is, and you get it with a little a special bobby pin that has like little diamonds on it, encrusted to attach it, and this has become the new Jewish look.
Okay, thedoilylady.com. You heard it here first.
So one of the things that's Jewish clothing to me is how married women cover their hair. So somehow or other, they have to have some kind of symbolic look. But then you go conservative and reform, and they don't cover their hair at all. And now in a place like Shari Shemayim, which is very liberal, there are married women.
So I'm going to avoid particular synagogue labels if I can.
Okay, but whatever. I'm just saying is that Jewish is, it depends on how observant you are.
Jewish means different things to different people. That's for sure.
Depending on their level of observance.
Right. I'm going to take Sylvia and Marilyn and Miriam, and then we're going to go further because there's a lot to say today. Sylvia?
Yes. Am I muted?
No, you're fine.
Yeah, so I forgot the real question, but I think that we're just so quick to judge people on the exterior of what they look like. I personally did not grow up religious, but I think that if you can accept people, how they dress in shul, and they don't know that they're coming to pray before God. Really, people go to shul 3 times a year just, you know, to meet everybody to, like a big party. So I think that once they realize who they're standing in front of, why they're praying, or what the prayer is all about, then that comes and says, you know, maybe those ripped jeans I shouldn't be wearing with the tears and the holes. It's just more important to dress, but what is appropriate? I wouldn't say Jewish, because all of these things that he listed here in the Shmat HaShik is not just Jewish. They refer to other religions as well, to the Amish, to the Muslims. It's not just particular.
Right, no, that's for sure. And I don't think the article was claiming that these would be exclusively Jewish.
Right.
I think that's true. Okay, Marilyn?
Well, I want to agree with Betty. I think the key word that I got of all these discussions was respect. I was brought up in an Orthodox queen and you dress yourself appropriately to respect the queen. When you go to shul, doesn't mean you have to wear expensive clothing. You dress modestly for respect to the Torah and the queen. And I always think of that when I go to shul. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what shul you go. People, how they dress is their own personal business. Right. But personally, the shul is, Shabbat is special. It's a special day, and to me it's a special day.
Right. I hear, no, the respect is very important. On the other hand, going back to what Sylvia said, you have people who are dressing the way they are, not because of disrespect, but because they don't know. And that's a whole other story. Marianne, I saw that you raised your hand, but I had said I was going to stop with Miriam's comment just because we need to go forward. There's too much to talk about, so I apologize. Miriam, you're closing this part of the conversation.
Okay. I want to talk about numbers 3 and 4.
Yes, well, that's where I was going to go next.
Which I agree with in different levels, of course. I grew up in Eastern Europe in bad times, and always we knew we are Jewish, we are different, we are great, blah, 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 but don't advertise it.
Mm-hmm.
Keep it to yourself. And numbers 3 and 4, in these times of anti-Semitism, is almost provoking.
Yeah.
I'd be very worried if I see somebody in my family going with these things on their t-shirts, somebody that can come and hit them or shoot them or anything.
So Miriam raises a very interesting point, which I think for a different session we would spend a lot of time on, which is, are Jews better off or worse off when they demonstrate publicly that they are Jewish? You know, they talk about Jews in France and in Germany and even in England being afraid to walk around with a yarmulke. Is the Jewish community better off or worse off when they hide the fact that they're Jewish? I think the argument can be made in our age specifically, not necessarily 80 years ago, but now, that you're better off the louder you are. Maybe it wasn't true thinking pre-war Germany, but I think that today, because of social media and because of the way that everything is filmed and broadcast, I suspect that being public with your identity actually works more in your favor, instead of working against you. There's a lot to be said. This is a discussion for another time because that's not directly on point. I want to make sure that we get to talk about where we're going with this because it's already 10:28 and I feel bad that, you know, I'm not getting where we're going yet. So I'm going to pause the conversation here and move a little bit forward. I wanted to talk more about 3 and 4. Maybe we'll end up coming back to them. I'm not sure. But what I want to do is to distinguish between, on the one hand, Jews and clothing, and on the other hand, Jewish clothes or Jewish clothing. Because they're two different things. Jews and clothing and Jewish clothing. In one sense, the presence of Jews in fashion, and Jews have historically played a major role in North American fashion, is a matter of Jews and clothes, as opposed to Jewish clothes. In other words, we became involved in clothing as Jews, but there was nothing Jewish about our work in the clothing business. If you go back to the medieval world, when the laws of Christian and Muslim society often prevented Jews from owning land or holding powerful positions, the only way to amass wealth was to become a merchant or to excel in some manual trade. If you look on your sheet at source number 5 from Jewish Life in the Middle Ages, Israel Abrams writes, "Tailoring became, in the course of time, the most common Jewish occupation." He's now going back centuries. He's not talking about modern times. And in the ghettos, on a summer day, the Jews might be seen seated by hundreds at their doors plying their needles and shears. By the beginning of the 18th century, 3/4 of the Roman Jews were tailors. Can you imagine? 75% of the Jews in Rome are tailors at that point. I assume it means 75% of the people age like 8 and up or something or whatever it was. But That's such a remarkable statistic. I think part of this would also have been because of international connections. Jews always went into peddling type trades in part because they could go place to place and find people they knew who would take them in and who would connect them. So you see Jews become involved very heavily in garment production, and interestingly, anti-Jewish legislation took that into consideration. So example of that, source number 6, in the year 1671, the Jews are readmitted to Brandenburg. They had been expelled. And we're told there are a whole bunch of rules for their return to live in Brandenburg. Look at this rule. The Jews must not practice any deception with their weights in buying or selling. We permit them to trade in new and old clothes, to slaughter meat in their own homes, etc. They're allowed to trade in clothing. This was considered a Jewish trade. Source number 7, the Charter for the Jews of Prussia in 1750. We herewith establish, regulate, and order earnestly that in the future no Jew shall presume to engage in any manual trade, nor venture upon any except seal engraving, painting, like artwork, the grinding of optical glasses, diamonds, jewels, gold and silver embroidery, fine cloth needlework. These were trades that Jews were allowed to be involved in. More recently, this led to disputes between groups of tailors who immigrated from different places. If you take a look at source number 8 from the Labor History Review in 1995, this is describing a period, well, you see the title, Uniting the Tailors, Trade Unionism Amongst the Tailors of London and Leeds, 1870 to 1939. There were also disputes between the Lithuanian Jewish tailors and those from Romania, between the numerous unions' leaders, between the religious Jews and the more secular anarchists, socialists, and communists, and between the skilled bespoke tailors of West London and the rag trade workers of the East. You had different groups of Jews who were involved in different aspects of the garment industry. The result of all of this is that the Jews who come to North America at the start of the 19th century, at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, become involved in the shmata business. And they do it on many levels. Out of curiosity, just a quick show of hands, anyone here with a family member who was an immigrant in the garment industry? A lot of hands going up there. I should have done a poll for that one. It's such a phenomenon. And I grew up in New York, where everybody knew about the garment industry. But I was surprised to learn that you had it in Canada also. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 9, I just gave you two links. One is to an article, Jewish Immigrants and the Garment Industry of Toronto, 1901 to 1931. And then the other one, A Stitch in Time, Winnipeg Jews and the Garment Industry. I knew a little bit about it. But it was really surprising to me to learn how extensive it was. I know that when people were getting sponsored to come over, when Canada finally decided to let them in, so people were getting sponsored as tailors and furriers and the like who had no experience whatsoever. But that was what you told them you could do in order to be able to be admitted to the country. The result is that Jews who come over get involved in sewing. They work in sweatshops. Certainly in New York, that was the story. They market goods as peddlers going from town to town. They build off of family connections, as well as the skills that they brought from Europe. And it was the perfect time. And that brings me to something that I read from Malcolm Gladwell that was really fascinating to me. In his book, Outliers, The Story of Success, I have to pause and just say, whenever I read something from Gladwell, I'm always conscious of the fact that he cherry-picks certain things to support his case. Like, you can't just accept the things that he says. If you really want to know a topic, you have to do research beyond what he's telling you. Nonetheless, what he brings in here is very impressive. It's a chapter called The Three Lessons of Joe Flom. Joe Flom having been a lawyer, and he's talking about the growth of Jews in the legal... But he credits a lot of it to the Jews who were in the clothing industry. And if you take a look at source number 10, 11, 12, we'll see the case that he makes. This is fascinating. Mariana, I see your hand up, but I'm not taking things, I'm not taking comments and questions yet. I'll let you know when. I also see Sylvia's note in the chat about her father surviving the Holocaust as a tailor. They put him to work that way and he survived. And that's a story that I've heard quite a bit. It's really, really something. So take a look at number 10. Gladwell writes about Jews who came over to North America knowing the business. He references families he has described elsewhere in this chapter. He says, Jewish immigrants like the Flams, the Borgnichts, and the Janklaus were not like the other immigrants who came to America in the 19th and early 20th centuries. The Irish and Italians were peasants, tenant farmers from the impoverished countryside of Europe. Not so the Jews. For centuries in Europe, they had been forbidden to own land. We talked about this. So they had clustered in cities and towns, taking up urban trades and professions. 70% of the Eastern European Jews who came through Ellis Island in the 30 years or so before the First World War had some kind of occupational skill. They had owned small groceries or jewelry stores. They had been bookbinders or watchmakers. Overwhelmingly, though, their experience lay in the clothing trade. They were tailors and dressmakers, hat and cap makers, and furriers and tanners. The experience is there, and he notes in source number 11, it was an inexpensive industry to enter. He said, I'm not talking now about working in a sweatshop, I'm talking about becoming an entrepreneur yourself. He says, the threshold for getting involved in the business was very low. It's basically a business built on the sewing machine, and sewing machines don't cost that much, says Daniel Sawyer, a historian who has written widely on the garment industry. So you didn't need a lot of capital. At the turn of the 20th century, it was probably $50 to buy a machine or two. Which, of course, $50 is a lot of money. Don't kid yourself. But you could get a machine, get two machines. All you had to do to be a contractor was to have a couple sewing machines, some irons, and a couple of workers. The profit margins were very low, but you could make some money. This wasn't only the story there at that time. I read a book recently about India. And a woman who did the same thing in the 1970s. But at that point in time, in that place, you could enter this business and you came in with skills. And here's his last point, which is where he makes his Joe Flom connection. He says, this leads to Jewish success not only in that business, but in other businesses. Take a look at number 12. The most important consequence of the miracle of the garment industry, though, was what happened to the children growing up in those homes where meaningful work was practiced. And when he says meaningful, what he means is you produce a product, not only, performing a service, and you're able to become your own boss. That's very important to him. He says, imagine what it must have been like to watch the meteoric rise of Regina and Louis Borgnicht through the eyes of one of their offspring. They became big entrepreneurs in making aprons. They learned the same lesson that little Alex Williams would learn nearly a century later, a lesson crucial to those who wanted to tackle the upper reaches of a profession like law or medicine. If you work hard enough and assert yourself and use your mind and imagination, you can shape the world to your desires. Now look at this. In 1982, a sociology graduate student named Louise Farkas went to visit a number of nursing homes and residential hotels in New York City and Miami Beach. She was looking for people like the Borgnichts, or more precisely, the children of people like the Borgnichts, who had come to New York in the great wave of Jewish immigration at the turn of the last century. And for each of the people she interviewed, she constructed a family tree showing what a line of parents, children, and grandchildren, and in some cases, great-grandchildren, did for a living. Now, he, in the book, actually shows you some of the family trees. I didn't reproduce that here. But he gives you an example from Subject 18. A Russian tailor artisan comes to America, takes to the needle trade, works in a sweatshop for a small salary. Later takes garments to finish at home with the help of his wife and older children. In order to increase his salary, he works through the night. Later, he makes a garment and sells it on New York streets. He accumulates some capital, goes into a business venture with his sons. They open a shop to create men's garments. The Russian tailor and his sons become men's suit manufacturers, supplying several men's stores. The sons and the father become prosperous. The sons' children become educated professionals. Farkas's Jewish family trees go on for pages, each virtually identical to the one before, until the conclusion becomes inescapable. Jewish doctors and lawyers did not become professionals in spite of their humble origins. They became professionals because of their humble origins. That's what leads them into this the professional life. And you see it in the fashion industry itself. So I gave you three examples here on the sheet in source number 13. Isaac Mizrahi's father was a pattern cutter and then manufacturer. Donna Karen, is it Karen or Karen? I don't know. Her father was a tailor. Her stepfather was a hat maker. And Ralph Lauren, or I'm told I'm pronouncing that wrong. Someone told me yesterday it's Lauren. Either way, that isn't the name he had at birth. His name was Ralph Lifshitz, so there. His father came from Belarus and wanted to be an artist and ended up working painting houses instead. These are people whose parents were in the business or had frustrated artistic dreams, and the kids end up taking that and building on it. But all of these, to me, are about Jews and clothes. It doesn't say anything about the business being a Jewish business. Jews were put in a position where they would have the skills, they would have the opportunity, and then they capitalize on it. But you could take out clothes and put in, you know, anything you want. If they had instead been plumbers or instead been whatever you like, you wouldn't say that's now a Jewish thing per se. Mariana, you've been waiting a very long time. What did you want to say? You're muted. I can't hear you. Don't know. Other questions?
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
I was born in Romania, and we had no one who was a tailor in our family. But when I got to Paris, I had an uncle who was in the shmata business.
Mm-hmm.
So that was good. Mizrahi was born in one of Iraq or something like that. He was a gay man that his parents would not accept because they were Orthodox Jews. And I bought lots of his shirts because I approve of that. It's nothing to be ashamed of.
So I'm not going at all anywhere near any of that. You realize. Nothing. I'm trying to go back to the Jews and clothing topic.
Yeah, but it doesn't hurt if you know a couple of things.
Yes. No, that's true. That is true. That is definitely true. I just don't want to get into anyone's personal lives. Right. Right. No, I understand what you're saying. Any other comments, though, on Jewish involvement in the garment industry? Or whether that's Jews and clothes or Jewish clothes? People are in agreement this is Jews and clothes as opposed to Jewish clothes?
Yeah.
Okay. Then let's go further. Because now I want to show you the flip side, which is Jewish clothes. Clothing, as I put it on the sheet, with a Jewish message. If you look at source number 14, there are links where you can find out all sorts of information about more Jewish fashion designers. But the idea of clothing with a Jewish message goes back towards some of the comments people made about the first two cases that we gave, modest clothing and respectful clothing in the synagogue. As I understand it, clothing fundamentally has two roles. There's function, and there's message, right? What's the function of clothing? What does clothing do on a practical level?
It keeps you warm.
Right. Physical protection, dignity.
It shows probably an image of how you think of yourself.
So that gets us into message. That's already into message. From a functional perspective, the point of clothing is physical protection and protection of your dignity. That's what it is. But in terms of message, it also sends messages. If you take a look at source number 15 from the Journal of Popular Culture, insofar as fashion interweaves wardrobe and skin, makeup and hairstyles, perfume, jewelry, and accessories, it mediates the shifting winds of social climate. from the viewpoint of semiotics, right? Semiotics, signals, symbols. From that standpoint, this pattern is an intricate system of cultural change and tribal belonging. Maurice Merleau-Ponty demonstrates that the human body is not only an object of observation, but also a meaning-creating subject and a medium of culture. Clothing does not just drape the flesh, but extends it. Clothing reveals personal ambitions, social aspirations, and the prevailing zeitgeist.
That's well said.
Yeah, I like that last couple of sentences there. I think really capture it well. Clothing makes statements about ourselves, right? It signals membership in a group, right? It says, I am part of the club, whatever the club is, whether I want to be or not, by the way, right? One of the topics I want to discuss later in the series, but I'll mention it now, is the yarmulke. I want to get back to it in terms of its significance in one of the later sessions. But I'll never forget, and I'm going to repeat the story at some point. When I was a student in Israel after high school, so I was a student in yeshiva there, but for a few weekends we went on a program that went into absorption centers for Ethiopian immigrants and Russian immigrants, and we presented Jewish content in the schools. So I walked into a classroom, I was in a group of, I think it was five of us, and the first thing the teacher does is tell us to turn around and face the blackboard. And then she goes down the row, pointing to the yarmulke each of us is wearing and explaining its cultural significance. We had no idea at all that we had such significance. We wore a yarmulke, we liked the yarmulke. But to her, and in Israeli culture, it's a big deal. Wearing a struga, a knitted yarmulke, versus wearing a velvet yarmulke, what color it is, where it sits on your head, these are all statements, semiotics, as the article says. So you're signaling membership in a group, whether you like it or not. It also, and this goes back to the respect point, it also makes statements about the occasion where you are. I got an invitation for something a couple of weeks ago, and the invitation said, cocktail casual dress. I have no idea what that means. Like, zero idea what that means. But I know they're trying to send a message. I just don't know what the message is. I understand when you write...
That will be very fancy.
But it said casual. Cocktail casual.
Blue jeans.
Apparently, with holes up the sides. I have no idea.
Those are identity, however you,
yeah.
No, it's part of your identity, who you identify with, or how you want to present yourself.
But here, I think it's about the identity of the occasion. They want to create a certain atmosphere.
Yeah, wearing a yarmulke also identifies.
Right, right. No, that's definitely true. I know what black tie means. I even know what business attire means. I don't know what cocktail casual means, and frankly, I'm happy about that.
Just take off your tie.
That's what it is? Okay, now
you
I know.
Wear a jacket, no tie.
Well, and it conflicts with another event, so I'm not going. But
a woman can wear a cocktail dress.
Sorry? A woman can wear a cocktail dress.
A woman can wear a cocktail dress.
But she has to wear it casually.
That means she doesn't wear a lot of jewelry. You don't wear a lot of jewelry.
Got it. Okay.
You wear a costume.
I mean, I'm told this is a lot more complicated for people who are not rabbis. Like, I can get away with wearing a suit anywhere, and it doesn't matter, because people will just say, well, that's the rabbi. But my point here is that in terms of message, clothing makes statements about yourself and about an occasion, and frankly, that's where the fashion industry excels. Because it associates messages with particular kinds of clothing. So now, by wearing that clothing, you're sending a message. Again, whether you like it or not, doesn't matter. Whether you know it or not, doesn't matter. You're sending a message. Your message might be you're stuck back in the 1980s. But you have a message. So I would contend... Sarah, I'm sorry. I want to go a little further with this first. I would contend that Jewish clothing means clothing that sends a message that is Jewish. So I would say, going back to our examples, the first example about modest clothing, that's a message that is fundamentally a Jewish message. The message of modesty, of de-emphasizing the body and emphasizing instead the soul, that's something that is a Jewish message. The idea of not emphasizing sexuality, that's a Jewish message. The second example, having refined clothing for attending services, I think also that's a Jewish message. Whether it means that you have to have a high bar of attendance, you block people if they have a cropped shirt, I'm not going to the specifics because I think that there are legitimate questions of what your boundaries should be and making sure you don't exclude people when you're inviting them and you want them to be there. But I think that is Jewish clothing. I'm not so much into the third example, and that was true in general for people who responded to the poll. The idea that clothing should be Jewish just because it uses Yiddish, right, is not, that's Jews and clothes. That's not Jewish clothing. The fourth example, clothing that sends a message of pride in being Jewish, whether you think that's a good idea or not, whether you think that it's safe or dangerous to do so, to me, that is also Jewish clothing in the sense that it sends a message of being Jewish and not just being a Jew. In as much as fashion provides beauty, well, you know, let me pause there. Did anybody have comments on that before I go to my next point? Betty?
The shirt that said, boy.
Somehow I knew someone was going to come back to that, yeah.
That, to me, if we want, if we're raging about anti-Semitic comments and things, goitoy, shiksa, but these are really negative, and
yeah.
I think it's totally inappropriate. And, when I first read it before class, I was stunned that anybody would wear.
Well, thank you for thank you for reading the materials before class. I appreciate that.
Very welcome. But I remember my parents were Montrealers. The cleaning woman was called the Goya.
Let's be clear. The word Goy is not inherently derogatory. It actually means nation, and in many contexts, it means Jew. However, I agree with you that because of the way it's used and the baggage it carries in society, there are plenty of other words we can use and we should use. You don't need to antagonize people. I think that's correct. Sarah, you were going to say?
I was going to say that there is an expression, Kleider machen Leute, that clothes make the person.
I've heard that, not in Yiddish, but I've heard it in English. Yeah.
There is a story in one of the Grimm's or Andersen's stories, kids' stories about a king who is so full of himself that he hires the best dressmakers. And one day, a dressmaker came to him and gave him nothing.
Right, the emperor's new clothes.
The emperor's new clothes.
Yeah.
And that's where the expression Kleider machen Leute, the
That's interesting. I didn't know that. Okay. Good. So, this distinction between Jews and clothes and Jewish clothing, I think, is important. But I think we should give some credit to the fashion industry. Because the beauty that the fashion industry seeks to create and to promote can convey a Jewish message. Judaism values physical beauty. We are taught, I gave you an example of this in source number 16, source number 17, that the king is supposed to be attractive. The first source there, number 16, Don Isaac Abarbanel is writing about why King Saul was selected. And the answer is, it includes, because he was handsome. He looked good, he was tall, as he notes here, taller than all of them from his shoulders and up. It conveyed a sense of power. King David, as well, in source number 17, Rabbi David Kimchi, writing in the end of the 12th century in France, beginning of the 13th century, says he was attractive and that made him suitable for it. We have that in numerous laws that we appreciate beauty. In source number 18, I'm just rushing a little bit because we got 4 minutes to go. In source number 18, we learn from the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, that one should use an attractive menorah. Use a clay lamp. And when they say here clay, they mean that hasn't been fired and glazed in a kiln and all of that, just clay. That you shouldn't reuse it the next night. You have to clean it first because it's not going to look nice. We try to use something that is attractive and beautiful. Now, I know that some are going to point out that Judaism also is suspicious of physical beauty, right? Source number 20, the classic line from Proverbs. In Hebrew, it's Sheker Achein Behevel Hayofi. Charm is false. Beauty is empty. Beauty is not an indicator of value. Great story in source number 21 from the Talmud. The Caesar's daughter said to Rabbi Yoshua ben Hanania, "Whoa, beautiful wisdom in an ugly vessel." That's what she says to him. "You're really smart. Why are you so ugly?" He replied to her, "Your father puts wine in clay vessels." She responded, "Then what should he put it in? You know, good point. What should he use?" So he says, "You're important. Put it in vessels of gold and silver." She went and told her father. He put the wine in vessels of gold and silver, and it went bad. They told the Caesar. He asked his daughter, "Who told you to do this?" She said it was Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania. So he gets summoned to the Caesar, and the Caesar says to him, "Why did you tell her to put the wine in gold and silver vessels?" He replied, "She told me, so I told her. She said that wisdom should be in something attractive, so I said you should put your wine in something attractive." Meaning, the vessel isn't necessarily good for what's inside of it. Beauty doesn't necessarily indicate function. His direct point, as the Talmud there explains, is that if he were really attractive, he would be invited to all sorts of social things, that he wouldn't be able to study and amass his wisdom, and he wouldn't be able to teach. You need to have, to not have so much beauty. So, we don't always believe that beauty is automatically good, or helpful. What we do believe is that we should beautify that which is great. We want to show that we want to highlight that which is worthy of being highlighted. We want to make something attractive if we think it's important for people. Best example, source number 22. The Talmud says that you're supposed to beautify yourself before God with mitzvot. Make for God a beautiful sukkah. A beautiful lulav, a beautiful shofar, a beautiful tzitzit, a beautiful Torah scroll. We want to make our mitzvot attractive because that shows how important they are and makes them attractive to people. One example of it, source number 23, the clothing of the priests who work in the temple is supposed to be for honor and for splendor. They're supposed to have beautiful garb. So there is a Jewishness to the fashion industry when we create and use beauty in order to convey that someone or something is worthy, to make it attractive. The last source on the sheet comes from 2002, the United Synagogue Youth's Guidelines for Clothing for Services. So you'll see that it says within it, during tefillah services, inappropriately short skirts or shorts or tight garments are not permitted. Shoulders must be covered for both males and females. No shorts or jeans are to be worn on Shabbat. Dress shoes are encouraged during Shabbat tefillot and meals. They're trying to convey this this idea that you beautify something in order to show that it is worthy. So in that sense, the fashion industry has a Jewishness to it. Jewish roles in the fashion industry were fundamentally about Jews and clothes. But the use of something beautiful to make something attractive in order to gain people's respect for it, that's a Jewish idea. And what I want to do next week, I'm going to stick around for a couple of minutes, but what I want to do next week is to build on this, to talk about beautiful clothing, the temple and the synagogue, and what goes on there. I'm not sure why I said temple and synagogue. Oh, I think I know what I had in mind. come back next week and you'll see what I'm talking about. So that'll be next week, God willing. Thank you very, very much, everyone. I'll stick around for a couple of minutes.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I don't know.